And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In honor of Mother's Day, which of course was yesterday, we're replaying a memorable morning show conversation from 2009 that has actually never been replayed since its initial airing. Here we go.
What is it like when we combine stories that take place in opposite parts of the world? What happens when a couple in America who cannot have a child biologically travel all the way to India and take into their own lives a beautiful one-year-old Indian girl? What is it like for an Indian woman to give up a precious daughter for adoption? And what is it like to grow up in a home which is your home and yet not exactly the place where you come from? What do you do with the hunger of wanting to know more about the woman who gave birth to you? What do you do with those kind of feelings? And what about the adoptive parents and the hurt and bewilderment which they might feel at that kind of turn of events? A lot of these stories and a lot of these questions have been touched upon time and time again in previous books and films and so on, but they are beautifully and sensitively addressed in a way that I don't think I've ever quite experienced before in a wonderful new novel called Secret Daughter. The author is Shilpi Somaya Gowda, and she was raised by parents who immigrated from Bombay, India, born in Toronto, Canada, so she knows at least a little something about what it means to have this sort of richly textured, complicated life. And drawing upon that and other matters, which we'll talk about, she has woven together these two stories, which branch out into still more stories. And it's a beautifully crafted novel, one of the loveliest I have ever read. It's now available in paperback from William Morrow, a division of HarperCollins. And I am excited to have these next few minutes to speak with Shilpi Somaya Gowda about her novel, Secret Daughter. Shilpi Somaya Gowda, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me, Greg. It's a pleasure.
So we are talking about, at its heart, a couple who consists of an American woman and a man born in India, Krishnan, who cannot have biological children and choose to adopt a little girl from India, given up to an orphanage by her mother when she realizes that she has given birth to yet another daughter, and her husband only wants a son. And so there is this very stark clash between cultures, and that is only the start of this richly compelling tale. Can you talk for a moment, first of all, about the personal experiences upon which you have drawn to fashion this story so authentically? Since some of what resonates from this page resonates with your own life, but then other things, I don't believe, are part of your own personal experience.
Right. Well, I, the part that I started with, the kernel of experience that served as the seed for this novel was a summer that I had spent in India as a volunteer at an orphanage. And it was when I was a student in college. I think I was 19 or 20 at the time. I'd been familiar with India because my whole extended family still lived there, even though my parents had immigrated, and we'd gone back to visit many, many times every couple of years. But I had never been on my own, and I'd never been to really the parts of India outside of where my family lived. So this one summer, I went to a new part of the country where they spoke a different language and ate different food, and I couldn't communicate with anybody, and I spent the summer with these kids at an orphanage. And I had expected when I was going that it would be a sad place. You know, that's sort of what I envisioned, that it would be not a happy place. And I found it was quite the opposite, because it was, 100 children living together, well cared for. You know, they were fed and bathed and clothed and went to school. And it was incredibly joyful. They were these just incredible kids that even as a young person, they stayed with me in my mind. I thought about them many, many times after that summer. And, you know, I knew their names. I had pictures of them. I could envision them in my mind. And at some point, I think when enough time had passed, and perhaps it was after I had my own children, I realized that those kids were not 3 and 5 and 7 anymore the way I remembered them. They were adults. They were 23 and 25 and 27. And it really got me thinking about, you know, what happened to them. And I knew that the kids had to leave the orphanage at the age of 16. That's when they aged out. But India is not a very forgiving place for, you know, for somebody to just go out with no family and very little education and try to make their way. Mm. And it's particularly harsh for girls. And so I wondered about those kids and what had happened to them. And that, I think that idea sort of percolated in my mind over time and became the inspiration to write this story.
By the way, how many boys were there in this orphanage where you volunteered?
You know, I don't remember exactly, but I think it was about roughly split. It was about 50-50.
Oh,
I didn't remember there being a tremendous number of girls versus boys.
Interesting. I mean, we would really, in a sense, not expect that because...
Right.
The story in your novel, and it's a story we hear quite a lot, of course, is that the traditional conservative Indian father wants sons much more than daughters.
Right.
At least at one point in time, that was true. Is that less true now in modern India?
It's still very much true that there is a cultural preference for sons, and some of it is based in economics. You know, most of India is an agrarian society, and it just is thought to be better to have boys to help you with the farm work. Some of it's legal because the property rights for a long time only fell just to boys and not to girls. But I think a great deal of it is just cultural. It's just become ingrained in the culture over time that that boys are preferred over girls. And so there are all kinds of practices that go on, some of which are really horrible, you know, to consider. There's infanticide, there's of baby girls after they're born. There are women often choose to get abortions when they know that they're carrying a girl now with the advances in ultrasound technology. They can find out early. Sometimes baby girls are just sort of starved to death and neglected. So there are a whole host of terrible things that can befall a little girl born in India, even today.
Aside from a very brief prologue, your book begins with a chapter called Dawn of Morning, in which this Indian woman named Kavita, is that how we pronounce that?
Kavita,
gives birth to her first daughter, and this is a daughter that her husband, the father, does not want.
Right.
And you write so potently about what happens, and the deep sadness and bewilderment and anger of this mother who has this beautiful daughter taken away from her, and she herself can scarcely contemplate what happens to her and never does find out. But I just wonder, what is it like as a writer to go to a place as dark and harsh as that? And how does one imagine what that feels like? I mean, I feel like you write this as though you've experienced this, which I know you haven't. And yet, somehow, on some level, you have very vividly imagined what it would be like for a mother caught in such awfulness.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was the hardest part of writing this story, was trying to put myself in the shoes of these women who have, you know, just unspeakable things happen to them that they have to try to survive and go on, in particular Kavita. So this was the one piece of research I was not able to do. I tried to interview people who had adopted, who had, you know, gone through infertility, and I was successful in doing that, even adopted kids. The one type of person I was not able to interview and speak to was somebody who was forced to give their child up for adoption, and so I had to just try to imagine it. And I don't think I could have written this story before I had children of my own. So, you know, I think that was a really necessary experience where there is on some level just that special depth of love and sacrifice that comes when you become a parent, and I hadn't experienced that before, and once I did, I used that, you know, that little aspect of how I feel about my own children, about how I seek to keep them safe, and sometimes my fears are irrational, and what it might feel like if I was forced to give up a child that I had carried and loved, and just, you know, take that kernel of the idea of the love and the sacrifice and project, you know, into a totally different scenario what it might feel like.
Something you also write about with incredible sensitivity is the ordeal of the American woman named Summer, who finds herself unable to give birth biologically. And there is, the second chapter of the book is titled Clean. I think at one point the term clean is used in the aftermath of this miscarriage. And I want to read just a few lines from what Summer is thinking as her husband Krishnan tries to give her some comfort. When he says, take this, it will help you feel better. I don't want to feel better. She turns away from the nurse. They don't understand it's not just the baby she lost. It's everything. The names she runs through as she lies in bed at night. The paint samples for the nursery she's collected in her desk drawer. The dreams of cradling her child in her arms, helping with homework, cheering on the sidelines of the soccer field. All of it gone, disappeared into the thick fog outside. They don't understand that. Not the nurse, not Dr. Hayward, not even Krishnan. They just see her as a patient to be doctored, a piece of human equipment to be repaired, just another body to be cleaned up. Have you been where Summer is, or otherwise, what was it like to imagine that kind of pain?
This was one area where I luckily was able to do a lot of research, because I didn't have any personal experience with what she goes through, and I knew from people, friends of mine who had gone through it, that it was a very unique experience and one that is not spoken about that much. So I read quite a bit, and I interviewed people who had gone through infertility challenges when they were trying to build their families. And I even had people read some of the drafts of the scenes that I'd written to see if they thought I'd gotten it right. And I remember in particular, you know, I had written something where Summer has a breakdown later after she leaves the hospital. You know, she has a sort of a public breakdown. And one of my friends who had experienced infertility read that, and she said, you know, that's not how it happens. It doesn't happen right then when somebody's showing you a baby picture, or, you know, it doesn't happen when you rationally think it's going to happen, because you're so used to holding all of this emotion in and living with it and feeling guilt and shame and sorrow and carrying it around with you, that it happens in these little unexpected moments. You know, it happens when you're pouring your coffee in the morning and nobody's there, or you're lacing up your shoes to go running. And so I changed that scene so, you know, she doesn't have a big public breakdown. She has her breakdown when she is finally alone, not at work, not with her husband, not in the hospital, not with the doctor, just a quiet moment.
Right.
And I thought that was a really great learning that I could not have come to on my own without, you know, doing that research and talking to someone who had been through it.
Here's how you describe that scene as she begins crying. She is home alone at this point. These tears are always accumulating, intensifying inside her. She pushes them down over and over 100 times a day, every time she hears a child's voice or examines a patient's small body. Until that moment comes, it always happens when she least expects it, a moment when she's doing nothing at all, rinsing her coffee mug, unlacing her shoes, combing her hair. And in that moment when she is unsuspecting, the tears finally rage uncontrollably from someplace deep, deep inside her she barely recognizes. You really help us understand what this kind of grief would feel like, and of course so often it is a lonely grief that people experience so much on their own. The grief of this Indian woman, Kavita, turns into something else when she becomes pregnant a second time. And in the her grief and anger over what happened to her first daughter, she changes. She finds strength and determination that she will not allow the same thing to happen to the second daughter. One of the things I really appreciated about your book is that I found myself entirely believing such a thing possible. And sometimes when you read books, we see a character like this transformed, and it doesn't feel real. It seems like the stuff of movies rather than real life. I wonder if you could just speak a word about maybe the challenge of crafting this kind of transformative experience in a way that will feel entirely authentic to us.
Well, I think it is a challenge because people do change, and we want characters to change. And, you know, as we're reading, we want them to learn and grow and become stronger and wiser. But it's sometimes hard to reflect that because it's such an internal process, and to write about it externally can be challenging. But when I was, you'd asked earlier about trying to put myself in Kavita's shoes and imagine the emotion of having to give up a child or rather have a child, first killed and then become pregnant again. And one of the ways in which I thought that character would take all of that deep emotion and mourning was to put it back inside her and build her strength, because everything around her, everybody, the community, the village, her in-laws, her husband, refused to acknowledge that anything bad happened when the first baby died. You know, she's not even allowed to talk about it. And so, again, she has to take all of that and keep it inside. And I could just imagine that, you know, simmering and then boiling and having it steal her resolve so that she builds strength internally. And she also feels the second time as if she has less to lose because she's gone through such deep mourning. I think she comes close to feeling like she's a piece of her has died herself, that she knows that she just won't survive that again, that she would rather die than to have another child killed. Mm. And so I think it's both a diminishing of her own desire to live in some ways that decreases the risk for her, and an increase in her strength that lead her to the point where she can say, you know what, I'm not going to let this happen again.
She, of course, determines that she will give birth to this second daughter and then take it to an orphanage where it can live out its life, one hopes, in safety. And one of the most poignant things about that journey, which she makes with her sister, who has done the same thing herself, is that against her sister's advice, she is holding her daughter every moment and staying awake and not wanting to miss a moment of this last day, even though her sister Rupa tells her that only will make it harder, the moment that you have to give her over. I just couldn't get over that, how, in a sense, this woman is confronted by choices, none of which are easy in terms of exactly how to do this. No matter what she does, it will be a terribly painful day.
Yeah, and she, I think it's another example of her strength that she has built, that she knows it's not going to be easy. She's making it harder on herself to do it this way. You know, she could easily have had somebody else take the child to an orphanage or, you know, just have it, have her sister carry it. But she cherishes each moment, and she tries to memorize the child's face. And I think by doing that, she knows she's putting herself through greater pain now and later, because she's forming a bond in two or three days with a child that she knows she's never going to see again. But I think it's an example of her strength that she's willing to put herself through that pain, as a testament to her love.
What is also striking is the next chapter of her life, the next time she becomes pregnant, she and her husband spend what is for them a great deal of money to have a new test called an ultrasound done, a test which reveals that this time Kavita is has in her womb a baby boy. And when that baby boy is born, it is a cause of tremendous celebration. But you write those first rituals that occur. These rituals she shares with Yasu and their baby are beautiful and touching, but the joy cannot transcend her grief. For years she has longed for this moment. Now that it has come, it is laced with sorrow from the past. I'm so struck by that picture. I think that says it so well about how, it isn't that there was no joy or that the joy was completely obscured or completely overshadowed, but the use of the term laced, it is laced with sorrow, I thought was a very telling choice of words. And of course, all of us with lives very different from Kavita's experience this kind of thing all the time.
Right. It's, you know, again, I think it's that unspoken thing that everybody carries things with them that go unspoken, that haunt you, you know, or that you feel regret over. And for her, it's particularly poignant because of how extreme the situation was, of losing two children before she has this child. And, you know, rationally you would think, well, now she should be happy. You know, she gets to keep this child. This is what everybody wants. She can live her life in peace. But, of course, she's the one who's honoring those girls in her mind, and she cannot forget them.
Right. Even in the midst of, for instance, those rituals where she is given gifts upon the birth of this baby boy, you write, they have showered on her all the traditional gifts as if this is her first baby, their first child. What about the other times I've carried a baby in my womb, given birth, held a child in my arms? But no one acknowledges this, not even her husband. Only Kavita has an aching cavity in her heart for what she's lost. And again, our heart just breaks for someone bearing this kind of sorrow, essentially all alone.
It's terrible. I think the fact that her son is so celebrated just brings up all of that emotion for her again, that, you know, her girls were disposed of or given away because they were girls. And so that the injustice of it and the, you know, the dishonoring of that memory is something that she always carries.
Hmm. Summer's husband, Krishnan, when they realize that it is all but impossible for Summer to bear a child biologically, comes very quickly to the realization that what they probably should do is adopt. This is something, an idea which Summer struggles to embrace. And in some respects, it seems like what is the breakthrough for her is a very poignant conversation that Summer has with her own mother. Can you share with our listeners what this conversation is about?
Yeah. Summer is struggling with the idea of giving up the dream of being able to have a child biologically and turn to the idea of adoption. And she visits with her mother. Summer is an only child, and it's something that she just accepted and never really talked to her parents about. And her mother admits to her that, you know, the reason she's an only child is because she just never got pregnant again after she had a miscarriage, and then she just, you know, couldn't get pregnant again. And this was, of course, many, many years before, and there were no fertility tests or doctors or anything like that. It was just accepted, you know, at some point you couldn't have any more children and you stopped trying. And she and her mother accepted it and moved on. But she shares this with Summer for the first time, and Summer realizes that, you know, she feels empathy for her mother because she grew up thinking, God, I wish I had a brother or a sister or a sibling of some sort, and she feels guilty for having had that thought. And she can say to her mother, who's feeling emotional about it, it's not your fault. But, of course, she's not able to apply that same sense of forgiveness to herself. She still blames herself for not being able to have children. And then they discuss adoption, and her mother says to her, you know, what do you think about it? And Summer says, you know, I just, you know, I can't give up the idea of wanting to create a life. And her mother says to her, you're going to be doing something just as important. You're going to be saving a life you adopt. And something about that resonates with her, and she realizes that, you know, it's not a hierarchy of how your children come to you, and one's better than the one way is better than the other. It's just about, you know, building your family and loving the child as best you can.
We are talking about the novel Secret Daughter with its author, Shilpi Somaya Gowda. We've been talking, of course, in this first part of the program, the first part of the interview, about sort of the genesis of this story, of the birth of this little girl, being given up for to an orphanage, of being adopted by this couple from America. And, of course, the story goes on from there to a very poignant story of this little girl growing up in an adoptive home, and in a home where there are some very different ideas between the father and the mother in terms of the place that India should play in this young girl's life. I wonder, first of all, if, as you wrote about this, I think with such authenticity, if this springs at all from any of the real life experiences which you had in terms of being from a family of kind of mixed cultural influences, or a family sort of transplanted from one place to another, in a sense.
Well, you know, I think I experienced less of that cultural dissonance than the couple in the novel, the family in the novel, just because I feel like I grew up very much Indian. You know, and both my parents are from the same region of India. They grew up in the same city. Their families knew each other. So there was a lot of cohesion there. The only challenge for me was trying to navigate life as a, you know, as an adolescent in a westernized culture versus, you know, my parents and their relatively traditional and strict values at home. But I think that's a different kind of tension than the characters in this novel face when they each come from very different backgrounds and fall in love without really acknowledging the role that cultural differences are going to play in their marriage and then when they adopt a child. So, you know, what I used as an basis for some of the discussions that they have is I think all of us have had the experience of meeting people, in university or, you know, people we marry or become friends with who seem to almost come from a completely different world, you know, whether it's the North versus the South or, different religious backgrounds, that you run into these clashes over and over in small ways. And it happens as the infatuation of your meeting wears off. You know, you may meet in college and have a lot of in common with your roommate, and then as those differences fade away, as those similarities fade away, the differences become more apparent. And so I kind of tried to paint their relationship as one that is based on a lot of common ground. They meet in medical school, which is a very intense, rigorous experience. They find themselves together because they are amongst the most studious medical students in their class. They also both feel a little bit like outsiders because she is a woman in the 1970s going to medical school and he's a foreign student. And so they find their common ground that way. And it's only once they graduate out of that environment, become married, and then try to make their way in the world that they become more aware of their cultural differences.
Those cultural differences play out in some really intriguing ways and sometimes very, very subtle ways. For instance, there is one place in the book where they are preparing a meal together, and Summer is asking her husband, Krishnan, if he's mashed the potatoes yet. And you write these words, Krishnan is so engrossed in the pages of India Abroad, he barely hears Summer. You need to mash the potatoes. The turkey will be ready in half hour. And remember not to add any pepper this time. My dad doesn't like spicy food. Krishnan exhales loudly. Spicy food? Only an American would consider mashed potatoes quite possibly the blandest dish ever created to be the least bit spicy. He goes on to kind of think about more sharp distinctions between the culinary norms of a place like India and the typical home in America. And we don't stop to think about how those kind of differences, which at a glance seem not to matter in the grand scheme of things, and in some ways don't, but they are very, very clear evidence of something that might be far more serious than bland mashed potatoes.
Right. I think in this case, it's just a sign of many things that they both sort of pushed down over the years, and the resentment builds. And Krishnan is equally to blame in this case, because he comes to America very much wanting to pursue the American dream, and he falls in love with his idealized version of an American woman, and is very content to let everything from India go in the pursuit of those two things. And it's only, I think, after they have a child and the child starts growing that he longs a little bit more for his connection with his culture. And, you know, by then he hasn't laid the groundwork with his wife to really make that a possibility in a meaningful way.
Right. And it's interesting how at some points he comes to view his life, their life in America, as something rather sterile. And when he thinks about what life was like in India, he remembers it as something much more potent. This is what he thinks about, for instance, when he thinks about how he and his wife are each parenting their daughter. Krishnan thinks to himself that she, meaning Summer, seems intent on preserving Asha in the little cocoon they have woven around her. It's not the way he sees family as a precious thing that needs to be protected. For him, family is a wild, sprawling thing, a strong thing that withstands years, miles, even mistakes. And again, probably part of why he views family life in that way, he idolizes that, partly because it's probably true, and then also because over the distance of time and many miles, he comes to probably view it very wistfully.
Right, I think that's right. And there are also, there are multiple differences between them that are playing into that sort of feeling that he has. It's not only the cultural differences between India and America and the way, generally speaking, there are differences between family. It's also that, he is one of several children. She's an only child. And I think that the experience of infertility and adoption was much more grueling on her and the way she thinks of protecting the child that came out of all of that struggle versus for him. I think it was less, he experienced it less in that way. So again, it's, the cultural differences are there, but there are also many other things playing into what makes this such a complicated relationship for them.
Right. I think one of the things I found most intriguing was, in a sense, the way their professional lives played out, and in particular some of the ways in which Summer feels a bit frustrated and maybe to some extent unfulfilled with her professional work. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about, and in a sense the kind of compromises she's had to make in order to become, in addition to everything else, a mother.
Right. Well, Summer and Krishnan meet in medical school and are sort of intellectually matched at that stage in their lives. They choose different specialties. She becomes a pediatrician, and he goes on to become a neurosurgeon. And so their paths start diverging at that point. And when a child comes into their world and somebody has to make the compromises in order to be around for the child at certain times, Summer is the one that makes those choices. I think this builds over time, and she ends up taking several steps, as she would see it, back in her career or down the career ladder. And, as a woman who went to medical school in the 1970s, she was pretty ambitious, very smart and ambitious and driven in order to be able to thrive in that world and compete. And so this is particularly difficult for her. It's also hard because, she and her husband did meet and begin as intellectual equals, and she sees that changing over time. And there are not a lot of role models for her of other women who are having to make the same trade-off. So, you know, this is one of the things that builds over time, that builds resentment between them.
Right. At one point, Summer is riding up in an elevator, watching the floor numbers light up in sequence. Where have the years gone? And what happened to that ambitious medical student she used to be? She recalls that desire to work up interesting clinical cases, do research, ascend in academia. Now she barely keeps up with her medical journals. Her career choices have meant losing pace with her peers. And yet even in her unassuming clinic job, she can feel like an imposter. And at some other place in the book, although I'm not able to find it at the moment, you have Krishnan experiencing great sadness and frustration, I think just thinking it to himself, that he and his wife no longer have the opportunity and or the interest in discussing medical breakthroughs and other scientific matters, which once upon a time was one of the things that made their relationship so stimulating and exciting.
Right. I think they both sort of suffer the loss. And I think this is of that stage of their relationship. You know, their relationship has to change as it goes through different seasons of life, and they both mourn that particular loss. And I think this is something that almost every parent, working or not, can relate to, even today. You know, I know a lot of women who've read the story have told me that they, even though 30 years have passed, they feel exactly like Summer in terms of, you know, the challenges she faces in terms of trying to balance her home and career life.
And, of course, this story is also of some differences when it comes to raising their daughter as she grows up and as she finds her ambitions perhaps diverging from those of her parents, and even down to as simple a matter as whether or not she gets to go to parties. And I suspect this is something that plays out quite often when we were talking about these kind of families and households.
Right. Absolutely. And this is, I mean, I think this is something that, you know, where cultural differences really do play a big role. I mean, I think every family has different rules at home. And, you know, in my home growing up, most of those rules were dictated by the world that my parents grew up in and, you know, what they deemed to be appropriate in terms of, you know, having a social life or what was appropriate to wear or how you could cut your hair, anything like that. And so Asha faces, you know, a clash between her own parents of you know, the two directions that she feels pulled in.
Mm. We should say, too, that I think one of the things that makes all of this feel so real, so authentic, is that we are talking about good people doing their very best. That, for instance, Summer really tries to appreciate the culture of her husband. And particularly a little earlier in their married life, they travel to India together. I mean, she is not antagonistic. She is not indifferent. I mean, she is really, at least to some extent, trying to understand and appreciate who he is and where he comes from, both literally and figuratively.
Right.
And yet there are certain occasions when that cultural divide is wide and painful. I wonder if you would just touch on a really interesting story which occurs when they are in India and Summer makes a very careless mistake one day in terms of something she brings into the kitchen of Krishnan's parents, which really underscores just what perilous ground this is.
Right. She's visiting his family for the first time in India and staying in their home. And although she's met them once before, she's really not that familiar with them or comfortable with them yet. And the cultural differences loom very large here because for the first time she is out of her natural element and realizing just how different everything is when it's not contained and it's all around her. So she goes for a walk one day and just to sort of get out of the house and be by herself. And she ends up finding a burger stand where they make mutton burgers in Bombay, and she's so tired of Indian food and everything being so spicy that she stops and has a mutton burger and brings a second one home to stash in the fridge for later. And she neglects to remember that his family are strict vegetarians, which means not only do they not eat meat, but it is nowhere in their presence and certainly not in their kitchen. And when her mother-in-law finds this, all craziness breaks out, and she starts having the kitchen thoroughly cleaned, which means basically throwing out every single item in it and scouring it from top to bottom. And so the servants are going through this process of purging the kitchen of what they think is, a taint that she's brought in, and he confronts her and it just demands why she can't be more sensitive to the differences. And again, you can, you know, in the conversation that ensues, it's clear to the reader that he's partially at fault too.
Right. I mean, for not making this clear from the start, I mean, he's making a lot of assumptions about what she is going to understand about
right.
that home and what's important to them.
Right.
And in the wake of this huge blow-up, Summer at one point is thinking to herself, is this how I'll feel in my own family, like an outsider? And of course, it's a precious moment because her own daughter is going to ultimately feel that same sense of being an outsider in her own home as she begins to become very curious about exactly where she comes from
right.
and who is the woman who gave birth to her. Her mounting curiosity about that, of course, is very disconcerting to her mother, if not so much her father.
Okay.
As all of this plays out, as Asha grows up, we are also following the story of Asha's biological mother back in India, Kativa, as that small family, husband, wife, and son, transplant themselves from the little village where they had been very happy. Just explain to our listeners exactly about this jarring, painful transplantation which occurs, and just a little bit of what they experience in this bewildering new place that does not at all seem like home.
Well, Kavita and Jesu have come to the conclusion that they can no longer forge a living in their small village. The farmland is just not yielding enough, and Jesu has heard these great stories about people who have traveled to the big city, which is Mumbai. At the time, it was there was not high-speed transport in between their village and the city, and it probably took, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 hours by road to get there. And so it's something that he proposes to her, and she reluctantly agrees to go. Go along with him. She doesn't really have much choice, but she's conflicted about leaving their family and their home behind and taking their son out of his environment. So they migrate to Mumbai and find themselves in the slums of Bombay. They're in the famous Dharavi slum, which is miles and miles and I think about 1 million people in the center of Bombay, and that's where they end up landing. And they have to struggle to eke their way out of there, and it's very, very difficult. They're sort of trapped economically.
And you describe this with incredible vividness, as though you have lived in such a place, which I'm sure you have not. Maybe you've seen such a place. This is one of the most dramatic moments when they first move there. As Kativa is trying to prepare this little shack in which they are going to live, working as quickly as she can, she squats down on her haunches and traverses the small room, banging the broom forcefully against the dirt floor. Her efforts create a dust cloud that makes her cough and her eyes water, but she continues anyway. If she can just remove this top layer of filth that carries the memory of other people's food and garbage and urine, if she can just sweep it outside, there will be fresh earth underneath, the kind she's used to. When her throat burns so much she can't continue, she sweeps the pile of dirt outside and returns the broom to its place. She waits outside for her lungs to clear and the dust to settle inside. She steps into the hut again and inhales. Yes, the air seems cleaner. Or could it just be she had become accustomed to the odor of this place. I mean, that's also one of the telling small details that we don't think about, what it means to live in a place like this.
Yeah, and it's and you're right. I haven't lived in it, and I've never actually seen it, seen the slums up close. I've seen them the way probably many travelers to India have, which is through the window of a car as you drive alongside these roads, and it goes on for miles and miles. And so I just tried to imagine what it would feel like, not only sensorially. You know, there's a lot of, there have been documentaries and books written about that, so I could learn those pieces of it, but also just what it would feel like as a mother, to realize that this is where you have landed with your family, and now you need to try to, make the best of it and try to protect, you know, your child in this environment that you can't find your way out of.
Right. And, of course, Kativa and her husband and son, after great struggle, eventually begin climbing into a easier life financially, although it is because of unsettling things that their son Vijay is doing. And that leads the story down a very different path. And ultimately, your novel ends not really where we expect it to, as the daughter pursues the possibility of finding her biological mother and so on. You seem to have made a conscious choice, however, without us going into any specifics, of not ultimately ending this story as we might expect, neatly tied with a bow. Can you just say a quick word about that?
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was trying to avoid. I wasn't exactly sure how I wanted it to end as I began writing it, but I knew I didn't want it to be all tied up with a bow, like you would see in Hollywood. I wanted it to feel authentic, and I also wanted it to feel satisfying to the characters and to the, and therefore to the reader. And so I struggled to try to find something that would be authentic to the story and realistic and true, but could also give a sense of hope, and give you a sense of where the characters might go from here. But it's not a Hollywood ending, and I felt really strongly about that.
It's a great choice. One of many, many great choices you make as you craft for us this story. So complex and yet easy to follow, and we find ourselves compelled to read it right to the very end, to follow these fascinating and incredibly real characters. The novel, again, is called Secret Daughter, now available in paperback from William Morrow, a division of HarperCollins, and the author, Shilpi Somaiah Gowda. I thank you for joining me today and for writing such a marvelous novel. I so enjoyed it.
Thank you, Greg. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're going to be having some fun with Zachary Simonini, who is the technical director of the theater department at Carthage College. But we won't spend too much time talking about that. Instead, the primary reason for bringing Zachary on The Morning Show is to talk about the fun experience he recently had being a contestant on a very popular television game show called The Floor, hosted by Rob Lowe. We will be talking with him about the experience on tomorrow's Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today is going to be a mostly sunny day. We're going to have a nice high temperature of 64 degrees, overnight low of 53 degrees, and we do expect sunny skies to continue tomorrow. There is the chance of some rain developing Tuesday evening and sometime into Wednesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.